Mike mentioned these World News and Prophecy seminars are kind of keeping us busy, Mr. Rhodes and Mr. Weber and I, and a couple of others that we've drafted into it, into the lineup for these seminars. We'll be busy this year. Beginning in January, we go out to Garden Grove, California. We are going to Cincinnati in February with a seminar, and then in March we go to Spokane, Washington, to take care of that area, at least give a seminar up there. Then we already have three bookings for 2008 in various parts of the country. Some of the churches have invited us to come. And I'm afraid we will begin to be booked into 2009. So it'll keep us busy just keeping up with the few requests that we've had to come in and do these. And we hope that will continue. And I think most of all, we hope we'll be able to keep up with the pace of all of those that desire us to come around and offer these seminars in the various areas. It's a lot of fun. We always enjoy the comments that come from so many of you about the publication, World News and Prophecy, and what we bring in terms of a live presentation. We hope you'll continue to read and follow the events that we talk about and outline in Bible Prophecy in light of world events, as well as all the other publications that we are put out by the church, the Good News Magazine, and all the other booklets that we have as well, and media products that we hope and pray will continue to be a benefit and to be used by you. But all of them are put out as a labor of love by the church, and those of us that have a part to be in them, and to do something live like this with the audience and the readership is invaluable for us to get feedback from you as to how the publication is impacting your life. And we do appreciate your support, your prayers, and your involvement in what we are doing here. My presentation at this point in the day is a little different than what has been covered thus far. We're going to take a microscopic look at a particular prophecy in the Scriptures and talk a little bit about America's pride of power and particularly how long it may last. We are in a unique position in the world, on the world scene right now. I think all of us realize the vast scope of power that the United States of America has wielded now for a number of years. And the 20th century especially, and now into the 21st century, America stands at the pinnacle of its power and influence in many different ways around the world. I'd like to read a part of an address that was given in 2003, July 17th, by Prime Minister Tony Blair of Great Britain. He was addressing a joint session of the United States Congress. And near the end of his speech, he had these words to say to and about America. He said, "I know it's hard on America, and in some small corner of this vast country out in Nevada or Idaho or these places I've never been to, but I've always wanted to go. I know out there there's a guy sitting and getting on with his life, perfectly happily, minding his own business, saying to you, the political leaders of this country, why me? Why us? Why America? And the only answer is because destiny put you in this place in history, in this moment in time, and the task is yours to do." America's had a very special relationship through the generations with Great Britain, and Tony Blair probably, as well as any other leader in modern times in our lifetime, put it there in terms of the role that America has played, and I might add what we have played even longer with Great Britain in the past, and that unique special relationship that we have had. But Prime Minister Blair put it very clearly in terms of the role that America has, that we have a moment in time, and a task that is ours to perform. And how much longer we will be able to do that is something that is yet to be determined. I think we all realize that the power that America has is divided into many different areas. We stand, as I said, at the pinnacle of our power in the world today. Really, there's no other nation that comes anywhere close to matching the power that we have in the United States today, and certainly in a military way. When we look at what the American military is able to do, we're not debating the merits of all of our incursions and what we have done over the years and even doing currently in the Middle East. We'll leave that for another discussion, but I think that it is realized that America's power is unmatched in terms of the ability to move troops anywhere, virtually anywhere in the world, and to transport power. We have the ability to do that. Planes can take off from an airbase in Missouri and travel halfway around the globe and with pinpoint precision bomb a location in Baghdad, in the Middle East, and then return without ever landing, with only a mid-air refueling or two, and go back to Missouri, my home state. And that can be done multiple times with the technology that has been created and the ability to do that. We can, with carriers, project power in the Indian Ocean and beyond, protect the sea lanes, protect American troops and American interests in the world, and as they say, defend freedom and the liberties that we have. It is a unique role that we have had, and probably as powerful as any other country has ever had at any point in time in world history. And that is the power that we have in a military sense. And as one historian put it a few years ago, the American soldier has gone into places in modern times not as a conqueror, but as a liberator, as a defender of freedom in world wars, in various other locations, at various times. I know that view is challenged today and by a number of people in other areas and other parts of the world. They would challenge statements like that. But perhaps what this Stephen Ambrose, who is, was trained right here in Wisconsin at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, perhaps what he said a few years ago does say something about the country as a whole and in a general sense, that American troops did not go as conquerors, they went as liberators. My father was one of those in World War II. He landed on the beaches of Normandy and as a young man and didn't seek anything of his own or that for his own country, only to liberate a people that he didn't really know, and he came home and changed and forever the rest of his life. And many, many millions of others of American troops have done that. And this particular scene illustrates at least a part and a dimension of the American military power. There's another form of our power as well we should consider, and that's the economic power that the United States has unquestionably in the world scene today. We are an economic power that is, again, unrivaled. We have the American dollar is still the reserve currency of most nations. Investments continue to pour into America. Dollars from Saudi Arabia, the other Middle Eastern Emirates, and from China and other nations pour into America because they feel that it is a safe investment. No one invests their money into something that they do not feel confidence in and feel that they are not going to get a return. You do not put your money into a bank or into any other type of investment that you don't have confidence is going to at least keep it safe at a minimum and beyond gain you a nice rate of return. That's the way other countries look at America. Regardless of all of our faults, regardless of all that is said on the political scene, the American dollar is still the reserve currency. And that power is another form of our power that for us is good, for you and I in a very practical sense as well. Politically, I think we also recognize the power that America still has. It is battered. It is being still shaped. But politically, we still have a great deal of power as well. There's another form of power that America wields, and perhaps one we don't think about, and that is a cultural influence, a cultural power that does very much dominate the world. Hollywood movies are the ones that everyone wants to watch. They have a worldwide audience. They don't matter so much how many tickets we buy when they first come out into the theaters near us. It's whether or not they get their money back at that phase of the development is immaterial. They know that once the movies hit the world audience, that they will receive their investment back because people in India, people in Europe, people in Africa and other locations, they like our culture. For good or bad, they like it. And they pay to see it, and they pay to emulate it. A year ago, I was in Israel, and we were having dinner one night in an outdoor cafe on the Sea of Tiberias, Sea of Galilee. And we were sitting there, my friend and I, Scott Ashley, the Good News Managing Editor, and we were having a hamburger and french fries and ourselves. But what I was most interested in was a table of Arab youth right next to us. I think it were about six Arab youth that were there, a mixture of men and women. And I just got to watching. They were having hamburgers and french fries too. But I kind of looked a little closer at what they had on. And they had on Nike shoes. They had on Levi's jeans. I think they had Wrangler shirts on, it looked like. And they were smoking Marlboro cigarettes. They like our culture. They like our brands. They like our dress. That is another form of power that we project in this world. Now, in some ways, that is beginning to turn on us, and because not all aspects of our cultural exports are all that good. I think we realize a lot of our movies, a lot of our television shows do not portray the best of America. They portray an immoral America, perhaps a greedy America in some ways, and some of our worst sides and worst elements. And unfortunately, they get certain perceptions from that, and that creates problems. I was reading this summer that I think in July, Playboy magazine launched an Indonesian version of their magazine, and it was being received with a great deal of protest in Indonesia, which is predominantly Muslim, by the way. And they did not like, the clerics did not like what Playboy Enterprises were beginning to publish over there, and they were stirring up a great deal of protest about that, and that was being seen in that particular part of the world. And what's interesting is this particular Indonesian version of Playboy did not even contain nudity. It was just the image of Playboy and what it stood for that was enough to rile the interest over there, but it was a completely different version of the magazine that they were publishing in Indonesia. But it was creating a great deal of animosity about American values and American culture in that particular way. This particular form of power is what's called by some a soft power. Not necessarily a hard power like a military power that can be projected, but it's a soft power. And it can be every bit as powerful in shaping opinions and shaping values and even shaping certain reactions. But we are beginning to see that is in the information economy and the information society of the world, the global world, that is beginning to have some adverse effects as it is coming back on us, particularly in Asia and in the Muslim world. The American libertarian and secular messages are not being received quite like they have, and there is a great deal of resistance there to that particular form of power that America is able to project. It does not always increase the world's love for America, and nonetheless, it is still a power, and it can make enemies, and it can make friends, and in many cases, it is making enemies for the United States at this particular point in time and on the world scene. Now, when we look at that, when we look at all of these forms of power, and we look at what we have been able to accomplish, to accumulate, and to influence as a nation, particularly in the last 100 to 150 years, as America came into its own in the mid-19th century and then into the 20th century, which some have called the American century, we won or helped to win with Allied support 2 world wars. We shaped the post-World War II world to our own image in many, many ways, and to our own advantage, and to, as some would say, the advantage of a free, democratic society. That is a tremendous weight of responsibility. It's a tremendous opportunity, and along with what Great Britain did before the rise of the American power in Great Britain with its expansive empire and the accumulation of a commonwealth of nations during the time of its heyday in the British Empire, together, Great Britain and America have dominated a great deal of the last 200 plus years in the world scene, and much of that, and by and large, has been a very positive thing. Now, again, I know it's not politically correct to say that today, that many of those who have turned against America and Great Britain and the West in particular would talk about the colonialism, talk about some of the problems that went along with the expansion of Great Britain's power and American power both around the world and even in America in our own sense in terms of how we treated some of the peoples, the indigenous peoples of our own land. And that, as I say, is not politically correct to uphold so much, especially in academic and liberal circles today. But nonetheless, by and large, where Great Britain and America have gone through these last 2 to 2.5 centuries, peoples have benefited from them. I had seen a list of the top 10 economic nations in the world today, and if you look at the top 10 economic nations, the majority of those nations are nations either Britain and America and or countries where we had a significant influence, in some cases where they were colonies of Great Britain and America, places like Singapore, South Africa, Hong Kong, where our peoples went, we left a legacy of laws and values and freedoms and a style that benefited, in terms of an economic position, those peoples and those nations. India would be another area that you would have to include in that as well. And that is part of the legacy that we understand when we look at the subject from God's point of view, as the scriptures tell us, has been as a result of the blessings God made to Abraham, to his descendants, that have been realized in our own modern times. And we tell that story quite adequately and in great detail in the booklet, The United States and Britain in Bible Prophecy, and the story of the blessings to Abraham as they were fulfilled, particularly in Joseph and his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Mr. Rhodes alluded to that in his earlier presentation. But we have had those blessings, and that's why we have had the power that we have had and the blessings that have come with that. Unfortunately, we have not always handled it in the best way. And we have primarily forgotten the source of our blessings. In America today, it is fashionable to look at the American economic miracle, if you will, and dream, as a byproduct of our own democratic, liberal, in terms of liberal economic policies. I'm not talking politically there, but our own economic powers that we have had, and we feel that has been as a result of our type of government and of our ingenuity and of our ability to create wealth. And we have not fully understood and realized that the blessings that we have received, the powers that we have, were given to us by God. And that is, some men in the past have said that the reason that we have been given the choicest places under heaven, the choicest real estate, if you will, is because of the blessings of God. As we come up to our own American Thanksgiving here in a few days, it is again good for us to remember that and re-understand that from a right perspective. But in recent times, a large portion of both nations, and America in particular, have ignored the teachings of the Bible, and we have not fully understood why we have been one of the most prosperous nations in the world. At the same time, we have also had some of the largest examples of immorality and other problems that we have exported, and we deal with ourselves in terms of crime and violence and some of the internal problems that we do have. And because of that, we can understand that there is a kind of a two-edged sword. We have been blessed, but along with that, we must understand from the Bible what it says in regards to those who hold those blessings, Israel, and what God says to Israel, that those blessings come with responsibility. And because we have not held that responsibility in the highest and fully understood and appreciated where they came from, and that it comes from the Creator God, and that His ways and laws are to be upheld, God says as well that there are going to be times, a time of reversal, and there will be a time of cursings that will go along and come as a result of not honoring and remembering the source of the blessings that we have had. There's one particular scripture that I want to focus in on as we look at this. And this is a picture here depicting the bestowal of those blessings by Jacob upon the sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, his two sons, that again are told quite well in that booklet on the United States and Britain in Bible Prophecy. But along with those blessings that Leviticus chapter 26 goes into in great detail, we also understand, and we're going to focus in on one verse here in verse 19. There is a statement that is made that as a result of not obeying God, when those blessings come, God lists in this chapter a whole series of curses that will come because of the disobedience to the covenant, to the laws, to the laws of God. And in verse 19, God makes a statement that is something that I would like to visit here in this presentation in terms of our power, and this power that I've been talking about that we are able to project. In verse 19, He says, "I will break the pride of your power. I will make your heavens like iron and your earth like bronze. I will break the pride of your power." Now, it's time to revisit that verse and to understand what we're being told there. In the Amplified Bible, it puts it this way. It says, "I will break and humble your pride in your power." I think we all realize that whether if you and I have a pocket full of money, a bank account that's in the black, and our credit cards aren't maxed out, and the house is paid for, there's a certain level of comfort that we are going to have. Not that any of that is wrong, but there's going to be the natural human tendency to perhaps be a little bit secure in what we might have, the material things that are in front of us. And we can have a greater proclivity at that point to neglecting our duty to God and our responsibilities there. And perhaps we might be even ourselves lifted with a little bit of pride. Perhaps you translate that to the national level, and you have some very large problems and difficulties to deal with there. The JPS version of the scripture says, I will break your proud glory. I will break your proud glory. Now, we have a lot of glory in America. Great Britain has had its share in the past and is still, in one sense, a unique country and still able to hold its head high, not quite as high as it once did among the nations. But nonetheless, we've had a proud past. And there is a level and an element of glory to what we have been able to have. But God says because of forgetting, because of sins, that can be broken, that can be changed. Are we at that point? Are we seeing the beginning stages of it? Have we been there before? It's a scripture and a concept that we need to examine and we should be careful with. And I hope by the time I conclude, you will understand how to handle this understanding as we look at where we are today in America and the role we have as we try to understand where we are in prophecy, Bible prophecy in the future. According to all of these prophecies that we can see and look at, we'll turn to just a few here in terms of what God says about our people. Mr. Rhodes was mentioning one in Hosea 5 this morning about Israel and Ephraim and Judah in a very short period of time having things changed and turned around. We have a lot to be thankful for today. We live in a very unique time in history, and we need to be careful that we understand as we look at the scriptures, those of us that look to the Bible as a guide in life and as we seek to understand today's world and what's taking place, that we understand particularly where the nations and the powerful nations that we have stand in light of this and how this particular prophecy will apply today. Let's look for a moment just at the past of the United States. We could say, and perhaps it has been said in the past, that this pride of power was begun to be broke a long time ago. I think we all realize that with the conclusion of World War II, America really had come into its own as a power. Great Britain was virtually bankrupt as a great power at that point. The two world wars of the 20th century had expended their vast wealth. And America alone stood at the top of the heap. So the Soviet Union, in one sense, was there, but internally, because of their system, they didn't have all that we have experienced in America. And I think we recognize that in the subsequent history and what has taken place. At the conclusion of World War II, which the Allies won, again with the lead of America at that particular point, but America had the ability at the end of the war to shape the world in a way that no other people had ever had the ability to do. In Germany and Japan, the two vanquished nations, we rebuilt a vanquished foe along democratic lines. Marshall aid dollars went into Germany and Europe to rebuild their economies. The politicians and the leaders realized that Europe could not stay down, not even Germany. And so we rebuilt our enemy and the other nations of Europe that had suffered during the war. In Japan, General Douglas MacArthur was virtually an American Caesar, as one author put it. And he virtually rebuilt that country along liberal democratic lines and shaped the constitution and that nation, which to this day is the constitution of Japan. One of the features of that constitution was that Japan would be a pacifist nation. Now, the newly installed Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, has just in the last few days declared that he is going to rescind that clause of the Constitution. I believe it's Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution that MacArthur engineered, that virtually made Japan a pacifist nation. They have come to see that they must be able to defend themselves with the North Korean nuclear explosion, with China, with the growing needs there in that part of the world. Japan is now realizing that they're going to have to be responsible themselves for their own defense, so they are going to rescind that part of the Constitution so they can put together a standing army. They already have the best equipped police force in the world, that's just another way of understanding that they've had an army, but they call it a police force for domestic defense. And so we see some changes that are beginning to take place. But after that period of time and the subsequent wars of Korea and Vietnam and even now in the Middle East, America has not really been able to shape the world as it did then. I think we realize that in the Korea situation. We still deal with the effect of that. That war ended, but America could not bring about a reshaping of values even on that Korean peninsula. Vietnam's another example there. We lost that incursion. War, whatever we want to call it. We are trying to reshape the Middle East into democratic ideals today in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And I think that we are beginning to realize that that is a harder job than was realized more than 3 years ago when American troops went into Iraq and, 5 years ago when troops went into Afghanistan after 9/11. You can't do it by waving a magic wand. It can't easily occur over there. And so we are seeing situations take place that show that there are limitations to the power that we have in the world, even though we are the most powerful nation in the world at this particular time. We see that the recent conflict in the Middle East has brought out certain internal strifes and divisions, much like what we saw during the 1960s and the early 1970s with the Vietnam War. In fact, the term Vietnam Syndrome has now been recoined, the idea of a lack of a political will being causing such difficulties that the generals and the troops on the ground cannot win the war. That's what happened essentially in Vietnam. And now we are seeing that is beginning to take shape in Iraq. And now instead of the Vietnam syndrome, they are calling it the Iraq syndrome. And that is this lack of political will to accomplish the stated goals of liberation or democratization of a people, establishing freedom within the nation of Iraq. And this political will and this bickering back and forth that we have seen continue to develop and to grow is threatening to, in itself, divide our nation. And so you see this idea of an Iraq syndrome talked about a great deal. And, of course, it's coming to a head here this Tuesday. And we will see whether this election will turn on the matter of the war on terrorism and exactly what will happen. I'm not about to try to prognosticate the outcome of this election. Regardless of who wins the House, the Senate, whatever, there's still going to be some large, large difficulties to deal with. It's interesting, 2 years ago, the administration thought they had a mandate and a great deal of political capital to spend when President Bush won his second term. But unfortunately, or fortunately, depending upon your point of view, he has not been able to even push through Social Security reform. And there's been stalemate in a lot of areas. And so, depending on how the election goes this coming Tuesday, it will be interesting to see what takes place. And it will likely turn into a further stalemate, especially if even there are razor-thin margins between the Democrats and the Republicans and who controls either house of the Congress. So we're in for an interesting period of time over the next 2 years. It's not the rhetoric, the division, the rancor is not going to end come Tuesday night. It's only going to begin to ramp up in preparation of the 2008 election, irregardless of how it goes this coming Tuesday. Probably the greatest danger at this moment is that the American public will decide that it wants to pull back because it's concluded that when the U.S. goes in, it always gets hung out to dry. And so we see that developing, and we have to wonder where it will take, where it will go, and what will take place. We are experiencing a number of threats. The Iranian development of a nuclear weapon is just one. I mentioned the North Korean bomb blast a few weeks ago. The lead article in this current issue, the November issue of World News and Prophecy, tries to put that together and to explain what it does mean in terms of American influence in that part of the world, in Asia, with China and Japan and South Korea and Taiwan and now North Korea with the bomb. what that will do and what that means in the larger picture of American influence in that part of the world, which China especially is wanting to diminish. And they want to see our troops gone. They want to see our influence pulled out of that part of the world. And so we are headed toward a period of time that many commentators feel is we are headed for a period of appeasement that is going to be quite dramatic for our country. There was an article or commentary written a few months ago by Tony Blankley as he was looking at this particular situation. And he was quoting some statements being made by certain generals about the inevitability of Iran getting a nuclear weapon in a very short period of time, and that that was going to necessitate some very serious diplomatic interventions. And in that language, he was saying that that is illustrating the fact that it is accepted as an inevitability that Iran will get the weapon, and how that is going to be approached is just more talk, more diplomatic maneuvering, while behind the scenes, people, nations like Iran that wish us no goodwill will continue to push their agenda, the acquisition of nuclear weapons, in their efforts to control their part of the world, their particular neighborhood, and again push back the influence and the ability of America to protect whatever interests are there, whether American interests or that of other nations such as the State of Israel, and their goals of gaining control over those parts of the world will continue on. So we are looking at and seeing some very interesting situations. Wherever you look today on the world scene, you see a great deal of anti-whatever it is that America stands for. Anti-white, anti-Western, anti-Semitic, and there is this effort to push back the borders of influence, the borders of power, the borders of control that America and the West have had in various parts of the world, whether it's the Middle East or Asia. And the influence of America is at a point that is still large, but precarious at this particular time in the world scene. We have to analyze and look at what does this mean in terms of our abilities and what might yet happen to us in the future to turn things around and to change the situation that we have. I was looking recently at an article that appeared in the German magazine Der Spiegel, and it was talking about just the economic impact of the American role in the world. And it was acknowledging, again, the role that the dollar has as the reserve currency, the one currency that all other nations want to invest in, which is good for you and good for me. And the point of the article was that that's because they have confidence in our government, in our society, and in the dollar, that it's going to give them a return, but that there are things on the horizon that could change that. And should that change, should some morning a central banker in Europe or an Arab sheikh, or another situation take place, another hotspot in the world that creates basically a lack of confidence in America. And they begin to roll their monies into, let's say, the euro. What that would mean for you and I would be dramatic. And we have to understand, brethren, that any change in America's fortunes is going to impact you and I and our pocketbook dramatically. We think $3 a gallon gasoline is something to worry about, and none of us like that. We're glad to see it down closer to $2 a gallon or $2.10 or $2.20, whatever it is. But if it were $5, if it were $6, which is what it is in Germany, couldn't believe what it cost to fill up a car over in Germany back in September. $6 a gallon for the gasoline, and that's what they've lived with for years and years and years. But if we would see the dollar no longer be the reserve currency in the world, and the confidence in the dollar to dramatically turn around, then inflation is going to go up, goods are going to increase in cost, your 401k and my 403 and your IRA and my IRA is going to go down. There are going to be some big changes in our lifestyle. I remember someone a few years ago making a statement that something to the effect, prepare now to lower your standard of living. It would happen. And again, I don't welcome that, and I don't get up, you know, rubbing my hands every morning together gleefully wanting that to happen. None of us do. your mortgage and my mortgage would change. The value of your property and my property would plummet overnight. And we would be left holding a big bag of debt. But as this Der Spiegel article was bringing out, that could happen. And the very fact that this German publication, and it could be any other European or foreign publication, writes in that way, again, just whether or not it's going to happen next week, next year, 10 years from now, it shows the potential for a loss of confidence right there. That's the potential. They see that it could happen. They see that it should, because we're importing far more than we're exporting. Our debt load is far more than it should be. China finances that. Saudi Arabia finances a great deal of that. And we can go to Target, we can go to Walmart, and we can buy goods that are pretty inexpensive because of a whole system that has been developed that we, in a sense, are captive to. A lot of things could happen economically that could turn around. All of these things could happen overnight and cripple the American economy. But why would that happen? And more importantly, let's understand that it has not happened yet. It has not happened at this point in time. Why is that? Well, it hasn't happened because there is an unseen hand that most people do not understand that has been holding it all together. And that unseen hand is the hand of God. I firmly believe that, and we need to understand that. Let's look for a moment at the story of ancient Israel and understand why it was that God sent those nations of Israel and Judah into captivity. We've got to understand that essentially it was for the sins of idolatry and Sabbath breaking, that God was abandoned Israel because they would not listen and understand his word. They would not listen to the prophets as God sent the various warnings to them. Let's turn over to the book of Ezekiel for a moment. And let's look for a moment at what was said to Israel and Judah by some of the prophets. Ezekiel chapter 20. And let's begin in verse 12. It says, "Moreover," God says, "I also gave them my Sabbaths to be a sign between them and me, that they might know that I am the Lord who sanctifies them. Yet the house of Israel rebelled against me in the wilderness. They did not walk in my statutes. They despised my judgments, which if a man does, he shall live by them. And they greatly defiled my Sabbaths. Then I said, I would pour out my fury upon them in the wilderness and consume them." And then down in verse 16, he says, "Because they despised my judgments and did not walk in my statutes, but profaned my Sabbaths, for their heart went after their idols." Over and over again, we find that it's because of idolatry and Sabbath breaking that God punished these ancient nations. And those same sins of those two primary, heading commandments of idolatry and Sabbath breaking are a part of the problem that we face today. Let's look at Hosea chapter 4. The first of the minor prophets, Hosea the fourth chapter, and let's begin in verse 1. "Hear the word of the Lord. It says, you children of Israel, for the Lord brings a charge against the inhabitants of the land. There is no truth or mercy or knowledge of God in the land. By swearing and lying, killing and committing adultery, they break all restraint with bloodshed upon bloodshed. Therefore the land will mourn, and everyone who dwells there will waste away with the beasts of the field and the birds of the air. Even the fish of the sea will be taken away." And down in verse 6 it says, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, I also will reject you from being priest for me. Because you have forgotten the law of your God, I also will forget your children. The more they increased, the more they sinned against me." And he's explaining again an increase in what? Power, prestige, economic security. They increased in all of those. The power that they had at that time in their day, they were increased, and as a result, it led to more sins. I will change, he says, because of that, I will change their glory into shame. In verse 8, they eat up the sin of my people, and they set their heart on their iniquity. And it shall be like people, like priest. So I will punish them for their ways and reward them for their deeds. Here's a summation of God's indictment of Israel as a people. And he says, like people, like priests. God always put the primary blame for the problems in Israel and Judah upon the priests. They did not teach the people the righteous ways of God. They allowed the importation of foreign gods and idolatry into the land. And even as they maintained a semblance of security and worship of God, they still had in their worship and in their religious practices, they had a systems of idolatry and false teaching that really caused the people to lose an understanding and a knowledge of the true God. In Jeremiah chapter 3, we could just quickly turn there and we can see, at least through Jeremiah's words, how this was brought forth. Jeremiah, the third chapter. Judah felt that they had because they had the temple, they had the covenant or the promises, that they would be able to maintain their position and their place in the world, their world order, despite what they did, that they could give God and pay to God lip service. In Jeremiah 3 and verse 3, he says, therefore the showers have been withheld. And there has been no latter rain. You have had a harlot's forehead, and you refuse to be ashamed. Will you not from this time cry to me? My father, you are the guide of my youth. Will he remain angry forever? Will he keep it to the end? Behold, you have spoken and done evil things as you were able. And over in chapter 7 of Jeremiah went and he stood in front of the temple on one occasion. And he stood there and he pointed at this magnificent structure that it had stood there for generations and in which they placed a great deal of trust. And in verse 4 he said, do not trust in these lying words saying, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord are these. For if you thoroughly amend your ways and your doings, if you thoroughly execute judgment between a man and his neighbor, if you do not oppress the stranger, the fatherless and the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place or walk after other gods to your hurt, then I will cause you to dwell in this place in the land that I gave you to your fathers forever and ever. Behold, you trust in lying words that cannot profit. They were trusting in a religious system that did not plainly tell them and explain to them the truth of God. And they thought that because they held the temple, that that in itself would be a promise that would keep them from any type of destruction or a reversal of fortunes in their national scheme of life. And God says, don't trust in that. The words and the situation are reminiscent of where we are today. We have a semblance of spirituality as a religious people in a religious nation. We have a feeling that we trust in God and that we are a religious nation. I could trot out all the statistics of the people who say they believe in God, they believe in the Bible as the Word of God, or say that they are regular attendance in church. What someone said recently was they may be in church on Sunday morning, but by Sunday night they're into something else completely different. In terms of their entertainment and in terms of their views and what they want to do. We have a very large disconnect in our world today and in our own nation in terms of its spiritual condition. God, throughout the prophets, always said to them that it was the fault and it was the problem lay at the feet of the religious leaders. God has a day of reckoning yet ahead for the religious leaders of this nation. Yet, when we look at these prophecies, we see that it is because that the hand of God is there. Now, there is a prophecy in the book of Ezekiel that talks about the presence of God leaving the temple of God. I won't have the time to turn to it. But in Ezekiel chapter 10, there is a vision of the presence of God leaving the temple. In his first inaugural address, President Bush made an allusion to this when he talked about the American story and the condition of the world at this time. And he had a quote from the Revolutionary period. He quoted from a letter that was written to Thomas Jefferson by a man named John Page, a Virginia statesman, who said to Jefferson at the time of the beginning of this country, he said, "We know the race is not to the swift nor the battle to the strong. Do you not think an angel rides in the whirlwind and directs this storm?" And what he was doing was making a reference to this idea of God's presence over Israel. And the founding fathers, at least those two in that correspondence, recognized that they had, they felt that the hand of God was on them. President Bush concluded on that inaugural address. He said that this work of our nation continues. The story goes on. The angel still rides in the whirlwind and directs this storm. I've often gone back and reflected on what he said then and wondered at exactly what he was saying, because within a few months we had 9/11 and all the subsequent events that have rolled over as a result of that. And by all accounts, this president has had rather a rough period in office. What his next 2 years will bring, we'll yet to have to see. And what lies even beyond whoever the president will be, I don't think it's going to be any easier. How long will the angel be in the presence of the storm that whirls about our country and our peoples? That's the question. Because as long as that is there, don't bet against America. Don't bet against Israel. And by that I mean the Israel of God, of which America holds the blessings and the modern fulfillment. Don't bet against it. Because as long as God's hand is over the country and that his blessing of protection is there, that power, in whatever form, will hobble along for God's purpose and according to his will. But when that presence leaves, as Ezekiel 10 shows, that when the presence of the angel left the temple, all bets are off. The pride of power will then be broken. And it will be a different morning in America. It will be a different time. And our power will have ebbed and begun to recede. But until then, as I said, don't bet against America. And don't bet against God. And God's Israel, and what God is yet to accomplish and to do. Now, brethren, readers, all of us, we love our country. We love the blessings that we have. We love its history. We look forward to a bright future. But at the same time, we cannot ignore what God says to our peoples through his prophets. And we have to understand that message and let it impact and shape our thoughts and our feelings about our people, because in that shaping lies a true patriotism that loves the country but understands its deep systemic problems that, if not repented of, will cause the power to ebb and to be broken. So let's appreciate what we have. In that same address that Prime Minister Tony Blair had before the Congress in 2003, he also said this. He said, "All predominant power seems for a time invincible, but in fact, it is transient." He spoke from personal experience. Great Britain's power had long since faded, the height of its power. And he knows, I think, to the depth of his being, the value of the power that America has to this day. But he'll be leaving office next year, and what his successor does will perhaps even change the relationship between America and Great Britain. Time will tell there. But the question is still open before America. Do we want to see our power fade? We would hope for a repentance. But whether that will happen, perhaps is yet to be told. Rome fell from within. Gradually, over a long period of time. We read this morning in Hosea 5 that it could happen very quickly within a short period of time in our own country, in our own experience. I don't think we have centuries to turn around a decline that is not understood. The barbarians have knocked at the gate once. Will they do it again? Will they topple because we have lost the will or the pride of our power? Time will tell, but we have to understand that. And leave that in God's hands, and in the meantime, continue on with the work that we have been given, and with the blessings that God has given to us, be much appreciative of it, especially in this time of national Thanksgiving.